Hello, Tome listeners. This is your Tome editor, Samuel Dillon. This week, the Tome Show is bringing you special Gen Con 2011 episodes. In order to get them to you faster, these are going to be released unedited. Our sponsor for tonight's episode is Noble Knight Games, where Out of Print is available again. So sit back and relax, and after a message from our sponsor, you'll get to hear tonight's episode. And this is the one everyone's been waiting for, WotC's new product seminar from Gen Con 2011.
Noble Knight Games has been serving the needs of thousands of gamers worldwide since 1997. With a huge selection of over 30,000 unique products, including discounts on most in-print games of up to 50% off or more. Noble Knight Games is the place for out-of-print RPGs, board games, war games, collectible card games, miniatures, and all things game-related. They ship worldwide and will purchase or trade your titles you no longer need, new, or used. Your satisfaction is guaranteed. Just visit www.noblenight.com or visit our website for direct access to thousands of new, out-of-print, and in some cases, one-of-a-kind items.
To our product preview seminar. So this year, first off, to introduce myself, I'm Mike Merles. I'm the Senior Manager for RPG R&D, or D&D R&D, at Wizards of the Coast. And joining me today are James Wyatt and Ronnie Thompson.
Then I'm gonna clap for.
So, here is Mike Robles. He's our Mike. What is your actual title?
He's in nobility.
My actual title is Online Community Coordinator, but I'm the community manager for one of the managers for Wizards of the Coast. I'm doing live tweeting from the Wizards D&D account right now.
A Twitter monkey.
Yes. Or Twitter monkey, as a Roger was
saying. So you can't talk to us because the internet people are more important?
Yes. I'm technically not on the panel. I just haven't picked the good seats.
Yeah, he is. Left
the I warned him that if we sat up here, we were going to make him talk.
Oh.
And you just did. So let's just start.
So
right,
today,
tell them about my nickname.
Just kidding. We're going to break the panel down to three segments. James is going to talk about our novel line. Roddy's going to talk about our board games, what we call tabletop, I guess that's as opposed to RPGs, which are still tabletop.
Yeah.
And I'm going to talk about RPGs. So, kick things off, we're going to start with James. He's going to be talking about our novel line.
D&D novels.
No, I'll take a seat.
All right, I actually...
Oh, yeah.
Yay. Right. So, as always, we have a whole line of novels coming out in the next several months. I'm really just going to highlight three or four key things, going through fairly quickly here to keep us moving. So the big thing, obviously, if you've been around the convention at all the last couple of days, is Neverwinter. Bob Salvatore's Neverwinter Saga launched last year with Gontalgrim, which is now out in paperback, and he's been signing that here at the show. In a couple months, in October, is the second book in the series, Neverwinter. And the third one is called Karen's Claw. You heard it here first. Also in the novel's line related to Neverwinter is Aaron Evans's novel, Brimstone Angels. I have to tell you, Mike wants me to stand up, but I'm going to trip over
the
cords.
Show him the bookmark.
Oh, show him the bookmark. I have 11 bookmarks I will give out to the first 11 people who come and grab one after we're done here.
Pile 11 people.
Or I could fling them out. No.
That's an idea.
It's all fun and games once someone loses an eye.
Wait, what? It's official Wizards of the Coast stance on fun.
Did I get that wrong?
Yeah.
So, anyway, I just wanted to say Aaron is an awesome writer. When this book came back from the editor and I started going through reading for comments, I got so sucked into the book that it took me like 2 days to turn it around. I really want to sit down and read the whole thing. And that inspired me to go back and read The Godcatcher, her first novel, which is also really excellent. Sorry, everybody, I can't hype everybody's novels the same way, but I wanted to say that. So also related to Neverwinter, we're doing a serial novella launching hopefully in October, written by Rosemary Jones. It's going to be a four-part story, about a quarter of the length of a normal novel, but spread out for sale as e-books at 99 cents an installment. So we're going to check it out and see how that works, see how you guys like that. So that is Neverwinter. Obviously, these novels are part of a larger Neverwinter initiative, which includes the mass adventure going on here and role-playing products that we will talk about in a few moments. The next big event in novels is the Abyssal Plague, which started off last year about this time, I guess, and winds up in April of next year. I have encountered some confusion both inside and outside the Wizards of the Coast building about exactly how all these novels fit together, so I'm going to try to sum it up for you as concisely as possible. Basically, there's two pieces of story that set the stage for the Abyssal Plague. One of them is my free novella, The Gates of Madness, which originally appeared in the back of five of our novels released over the course of last year, which takes place 300-ish years ago in the current timeline of D&D, and introduces the start of the Abyssal Plague into the multiverse. The climax of that story takes place in the plane of Pandemonium, where cultists of Therizdun are at work. The next piece of that is The Mark of Narrath by Bill Slavicek, which is really a story all on its own, except that one of the villains moving through the story is deeply involved with the Abyssal Plague, and it sets the scene for some of what happens next. Then there is the Abyssal Plague trilogy, which are identified across the top of the book by the Abyssal Plague trilogy. You can just barely see it, book one, two, or three. The first one of those, Temple of Yellow Skulls, came out last year. Oath of Vigilance, by me, is out this month, I think. I just got a Goodreads email this morning saying, here's a new author by a new book by an author on your show. Awesome. And The Eye of the Chained God is the third one, coming out in April next year. So that is kind of the core story of the Abyssal Plague as it affects the world of Benentir Vale, the core D&D world. It features some of the same characters that appeared in The Mark of Narrath, but it's the trilogy. That trilogy kind of stands on its own as a story moving from beginning to end. And then there are three novels that kind of veer off in different directions to the side of the Abyssal Plague, specifically Into the Forgotten Realms and Dark Sun. Sword of the Gods came out earlier this year, written by Bruce Cordell. Then Under the Crimson Sun, I don't remember when it came out. Also, just a couple months ago, is the Dark Sun Abyssal Plague novel. And Eric Scott DeBee's Shadowbane is coming out in September as an ebook exclusive.
Hey, Eric Scott DeBee.
Right there in the second row, ladies and gentlemen.
It's like this. I only have the one bookmark.
So you have to fight for it.
You guys can fight James for it. No,
he'll take on old Noah.
I have some left in the booth. I don't know.
This is also another daring experiment we're trying, releasing a book, at least initially, only as an ebook. But in order to make that exciting, we've jammed it packed full of additional stuff. There's some background information on Luskan and Abyssal Plague demons that are related to the novel. There's an additional short story that Eric wrote for this release. There's a background piece on the Abyssal Plague and how it came to be, which is, it draws on material that appeared on the design and development column that Bruce Cordell and I wrote when our books came out. But I fleshed that out and expanded it. And it's got preview chapters from some of the other books in the series. So it's a value-packed ebook. We'll be interested to see how folks respond to that. And that's all I got in the Abyssal Plague. This was going to be quick, and I'm just going on and on.
Excuse me, it's the last time I have to speak.
So. All right. Speaking of ebooks, we are now in the mode where whenever we release a physical novel, our goal is to get the ebook out at the same time. It doesn't always happen, but it's generally very close. At the same time, we're also working through our backlist at a pretty astonishing pace. It turns out we release about 3 backlist novels as ebooks every week. So we're looking at nearly 150 over the course of a year. So, for example, this month we're starting R.A. Salvatore's Cleric Quintet, coming out as ebooks, as well as Elaine Cunningham's Starlight and Shadows trilogy, and Margaret Weiss's Dark Disciple trilogy. So a lot of classics coming back to the forefront of publication as ebooks this month. So that is my quick highlight of what's exciting in our novels. I do have another slide, but I just wanted to make sure I didn't miss anything in my notes here. So the other thing is just, there's lots more. Shelley Mazenoble's new book is coming out in a couple of months. I just love this cover. I don't know how well you can see it, but Venom in Her Veins by Tim Pratt is a cool little story set in the jungles of Chult. And with that, I will turn it over to Rodney.
You've been a grave error.
I could sit down and drink my water. Yes.
Hi, I'm Rodney Thompson. I'm the tabletop games manager at Wizards. I run all the D&D board games and any other non-RPG games for Dungeons & Dragons. So I'm going to talk a little bit about a couple of things that have already come out and some things that are coming out soon, and also have at least one new thing to talk about, too. So Conquest of Nerath came out earlier this year. It is a territory control game where you control massive armies swarming over the world of Nerath. This game has been out for a couple months now. It's getting really great response. I just wanted to bring it up here again because a lot of people haven't actually gotten a chance to play it, and we do have copies for play up in the Sagamore Ballroom. So if you like territory control games, if you like war games, things like that, I highly recommend you get up there and check it out because everyone that's come away from that has had a really good response. It's a design a long time in coming. Rich Baker did the first design for it years and years and years ago, and then finally when we launched the new board games line, we had a chance to bring it out. So I think you guys will find it a really great game, and that's all I really want to say about that. So we've had a lot of success, both critical and then fan based as well, with our adventure system games that kicked off last year with Castle Ravenloft. And in fact, we were here at the show. At this show last year, previewing Castle Ravenloft. Earlier this year, we released Wrath of Ashardalon, which is a follow-up game. Both of these games use the same basic system. We call it our adventure system. And they are great, fun, cooperative games that have a lot of interconnectivity between them. So if you buy Castle Ravenloft and you buy Wrath of Ashardalon, you can mix and match most, if not all, of the elements that come with those. So the monster cards from one work with the other one, etc. So now, we've got our third game in the Adventure Game series coming out. That's Legend of Drizzt. Some of you guys might have already seen that game here at the show. We've been previewing it. It's up in the Sagamore Ballroom if you guys want to check it out. Also, one of my designers, Peter Lee, wave Peter, has been showing it off to people here at the show. Legend of Drizzt obviously deals a lot with the famous character Drizzt Do'Urden and his companions from R.A. Salvatore's novel series, mini-novel series, I should say. And some of the great things about this game are that instead of heroes that we've sort of made up for the game, you're actually going to play heroes that you recognize from the Salvatore novels. You've got Wolfgar, you've got Drizzt, you've got Geddy Bree. Those are not only new characters for sort of the classes you expect, but you'll also find lots of new twists on those characters' classes. For example, this one has sort of an archer class in it that's a little bit different, as well as having new powers for your existing classes. It includes some of the same innovations that you saw in Wrath of Ashardalon, as well as a few new game mechanics as well on top of that. So like the previous two, it is a completely standalone game, but if you happen to own the other two Adventure System games, it will work. You will be able to mix monster cards, treasure cards, encounter cards, etc. So it is just yet another expansion on the game. We think it's really great. We've got a lot of positive response from the people we've showed it to. A lot of people said that it is just sort of showing the maturation of this adventure system. And we hope that going forward, we can continue to provide constant improvements on the adventure system games.
So now we have a blank slide I want to talk about for a second. We had a game called Dungeon of Doom. Dungeon of Dread, sorry. That we'd announced for December release. And we have gone ahead and canceled that game. That is a game that was part of our new tabletop team that Rodney leads. We do extensive play testing of all our games. We have a very rigid design process. And we felt at the end of the day that as we neared the kind of final choice for this game, that based on play test feedback, based on how we looked at the design, it just wasn't up to snuff. We are dedicated to whenever we do a product, it's with the absolute highest quality in the industry, bar none. And if a game doesn't match that, we are not going to release it. We're not going to go ahead with it. At this very panel last year, we talked about how we had real issues with the router that we wanted to address, and this all ties back into it. That if it isn't quality, if it isn't the best, we're not going to do it. So I just want to kind of chime in and I know if some of you may have heard, we did announce the game. I believe it's on our online catalog. So I just want to get that out there. Now, that doesn't affect the board game line as a whole, because Rodney now has something else to talk about.
Something really exciting, or at least I think so. So Lords of Waterdeep is a new board game that will be coming out next year. It is a Euro-style board game. So if you've ever played any Euro games, you know what that means. Basically, it's a competitive game of intrigue set in the City of Splendors, Waterdeep. It is a game where you take on the role of one of the Lords of Waterdeep and basically are recruiting adventurers, sending them out on quests, and then also putting all of your plans into motion, backstabbing other Lords of Waterdeep, or also cooperating with them as well. This game is very near and dear to my heart. It was actually, to tell a little bit of an interesting story about it, last year I took the game train from Seattle to Chicago. Some of you guys may have heard of that. And on the train, I had a bolt of inspiration and pounded out a 4-page design document on this game. And then I got back to the office, and Peter Lee, one of my designers, was like, I see. Here's how you do all the math for this game. I was like, at last, right? And put together a prototype, and this game has led sort of a charmed life, in that every time we've played it, from the very beginning, even the very first super primitive prototype, which was like stickers on a dungeon tile, right? It's been a lot of fun. We've gotten great response from all the people we've shown this game to as well, and I think that people who like Euro games are really going to be excited about this. There's, in true Eurogame fashion, there are no dice, there's less randomness, it's a lot of cards, tiles. This comes out in March, I believe, of next year, and I don't really know what else to say about it that would not sound like me bragging on it too much.
Tell about the coins.
Oh, yeah. So this is actually a totally cool thing. So Kevin Smith is our art director on this game, and Kevin is super awesome. He was Emmy nominated last night for some of the work that he did. And if you notice in the top right of the game, or the slide here, there are some coins, some square coins and some crescent coins. So during the design process of this game, at the point where our art director was coming in, Peter and Kevin started going through old Forgotten Realms books, like second edition Forgotten Realms books, looking for anything that we could pull out to use in this game. And those coins are actually coins that were featured in some second edition sourcebook as the coins that you get or that they use in Waterdeep. So we've modeled the money in this game after the money presented back in that second edition book. You'll find a lot of the buildings that we have in the game, like the Spire of Morning, the Palace of Waterdeep there, all named after buildings taken from the classic Forgotten Realms, the classic City of Splendors.
Matt James gives two thumbs up to the coin design.
It sure does. Waterdeep box set.
I will say this also. One of the books that was heavily relied upon was the Volo's Guide to Waterdeep. If you guys remember Volo's Guides, they are fantastic books, by the way, and I love them. And so Volo's Guide to Waterdeep was like, oh, we need a name for this building that we've got in this. Oh, it's right here, right? It's everything about this game is tied really deeply into the classic City of Splendors. And I think that when this comes out next year, it's really going to show you guys that we're looking to expand our board games into all kinds of different areas. Euro games, the territory control games, adventure system games, any kind of board game that's out there right now, we're looking to find a way to bring D&D to that. And this is our sort of first step in a new direction, just like Conquest of Neroth is our first step into the war game direction as well.
But we're going fast. It's only like quarter past.
So we'll have lots of time for Q&A.
Exactly. I hope you brought your questions. Hopefully we brought our answers. So I'm going to talk about the role-playing line. We're going to talk about the next 6 or so months of what's coming down the road. And we're going to start with our releases at this convention, Neverwinter. Now, how many people have signed up for one of the factions in the game? Cool. Okay. One of the things we're doing with Neverwinter is we have, obviously, the campaign setting book. If you haven't seen it yet, basically the idea behind it is it's a DM source book for the actual city, and then the first half is a player's source book for the city. And the way we built it was under the assumption that if you wanted to start a campaign set there, the players can take the player material, there are character themes, other options there, that tie your character to the city. So, for example, if you want to be in Uthgut Barbarian and you choose that theme, that actually then ripples back into the DM section where he has story hooks that just relate to, hey, if you're part of this tribe, here's an NPC who's part of this tribe too, and here's what he thinks of the tribe. Maybe he's an outcast. He doesn't like tribe members. Maybe he, was been enslaved by, he was off raiding, got enslaved by some guy, and if he sees a fellow tribe member, he'll ask for help escaping, and things like that. So it gives the DM a lot of story hooks. The players can choose options that kind of point to the DM what parts of the city, and as you kind of go through and explore and meet NPCs and stuff, how they might react to you. So to really integrate character creation and campaign creation together. We also have a fortune card set that ties into this, and an encounter season. The game day is today. That the gates of
Never Death Adventure is running in the Sagamore Ballroom, and if you create a character for that adventure, you can then take that character into the encounter season. So we're pretty excited about it, and it's kind of pointing us in the direction of how we want to start creating story elements, mechanical elements that really work well together to create a cohesive campaign.
And the Game Day Adventure and the Encounter Season both highlight that in practice. As I was running the Encounter Season for press groups over the last couple of days, I really tried to bring that out, that even in the very first encounter of the season, you've got a chance to interact with NPCs who are going to react to you differently depending on what your theme is. It's very cool. Sorry.
No. So the next coming up, I look over James's shoulder here to make sure I get this stuff right. In September is a super adventure, Gardmore Abbey, that James, if I believe, you actually work on this adventure.
I was the lead designer for it.
So as you can see, one of the things we're trying to do with the super adventure is really bring the super with components. So if you can take a look at the slide, we've got poster maps, we have monster tokens, and we also have the deck of many things in this adventure. Do you want to talk a little about this, James?
Sure. I actually have been using the phrase deluxe adventure rather than super adventure because it's 32 pages more text than our folio adventures for 4th edition. So not quite as big as our hardcover super adventures. And really the scope of the adventure is not much bigger than those. It covers about 3 levels of play. But what that extra book adds is just tons of story. That book specifically is full of quests, patrons, villains with their agendas fleshed out, and it's a really open-ended adventure where you might have 1 to 4 or 5 different people who are sending you into the ruins of Gardmore Abbey for specific purposes. We really made an effort through the encounter design. Steve Townsend and Creighton Broadhurst were the 2 freelancers working on it with me. They really tried to create options other than combat for many of the encounters. So if you're wandering through the Fey Grove on the grounds of the Abbey and run into a group of nymphs, slaughtering them might not be the only or best option. In addition to the deck of many things, there's a couple of cards that represent unique treasure objects found in the adventure as well. So it's pretty awesome.
Yeah, we really wanted to get away. We've been obviously going back, listening to feedback on some of our adventures, and really getting away from a linear, just point A to point B to point C adventure. That's something we're kind of guilty of, and we're kind of going back here, something that's much more wide open, more of a playground for the DM and players.
I want to talk more about the Deck of Many Things, too. I forgot.
Sure, go for it.
So the Deck of Many Things has always been kind of this weird artifact in D&D where you find it as a whole, and as soon as you use it, it goes away. So that is still true, except that at the start of the adventure, the Deck of Many Things is scattered. So you might actually begin the adventure with a card or acquire them over the course of the adventure. Some of the reason that some of the villains in the adventure are the masterminds is because they've already collected a couple of cards. And in every encounter where one or more cards are present, there's a random element related to the effects of the cards that keeps things pretty interesting. So the deck actually casts its spell over the entire adventure. It's not just something that you draw a card from once and then you suffer its whimsical effects and it disappears.
So I have a little component list up here I'll read off. It's 32-page books, 2 double-sided battle maps, a sheet of tokens for monsters. There's actually a sheet of dungeon tiles in here, too, that you can use with the maps or with the core set of dungeon tiles we've done. There is also the 24-card deck of many things, and there's also the treasure cards that James mentioned, and it all comes in a box.
So the maps in the adventure are designed that if you have the dungeon tiles master sets, and if you have the tokens from the monster vault and the DM kit, you have everything you need to make with the token sheet and the dungeon tile sheet in this adventure, there's everything you need to run to make the maps and run the monsters in this adventure.
Next up. So, Morton Kanan's Magnificent Emporium, which is a fun title to say, especially when you're having meetings and you keep repeating it over and over again. This book was pulled off the schedule, and now it is popped back on. As I mentioned earlier, we are looking at quality across the board and everything. So this is a great example of a book where when we pulled it, we did a lot more playtesting. We actually have a body of playtesters. Greg Bilson isn't here, but he's in charge of running them. Everything we do now is going through extensive playtesting internally and externally. And this is a book that we spent a lot of time getting things right. The other thing to keep in mind about this book, it is a core exclusive, which means essentially it is going to be available at game stores only. Now, as far as the book itself, as far as the business stuff, this is full of magical items attached to the rarity system that we introduced last year with the Essentials line. It also includes character options for, say, using things like flails or other different weapons. It includes new types of mundane armor. I believe it has rules for followers and henchmen. And so basically it's just saying not, it's not just magical items. We wanted to get beyond just a book of magic items and make it a book of anything you could buy. That was kind of one of our guiding principles behind it. So it's got a lot more variety than we had in say, the Adventurer's Vault series that were released at the start of 4th edition.
I just love the fact that scattered in the lower right-hand corner of the book cover there, you can see the card backs from the deck of many things.
So in addition to products we put into stores for sale, we also put out stuff in stores for you guys to play. So launching in September is the Lair Assault organized play experience. So the idea behind Lair Assault is with encounters, we have an adventure where you can go week to week, level up your character, and go through a story, which is great. With Lair Assault, though, we want to do something that's a lot more focused on like the kind of combat puzzle aspect of D&D, where basically you show up with a character you built. The DM has an adventure, essentially it's a map, a basic scenario breaking down the contents. In this case, in the first one, the Forge of the Dawn Titan, it's a small dungeon, and the DM has a menu of monsters and other hazards he can plant throughout that little dungeon. And the group's goal is, in this specific case, is to get to that dungeon and kill the bad guy. So it's a little bit of an adversarial thing where the DM tries to create the hardest encounters and the players try to make the most powerful characters. So, and one of the things we want to do with this series is obviously a bit of a different experience. It's more for power gamers, and we're kind of unabashedly embracing that. You know, we're saying, hey, there are people who like the power game, people like to optimize characters, and this is exactly for them. And that's kind of the thing we're trying to do is create a little more variety in what we're offering for organized play. And one of the twists we can do after Forge of the Dawn Titan in December, the second Lair Assault is Talon of Umberley. So what we want to do in each Lair Assault adventure is have, create kind of a different, unique adventure. The first one is kind of a traditional dungeon with a fire theme, as you can tell from the cover, with a tiefling wizard and burning skeletons. The second one is more of a pirate kind of theme, where you're racing to find an artifact that's hidden aboard one of several derelict ships, and then dealing with the changing environment that goes around it. So each time you play, not only within each Lair Assault is it different, because the DM can change what's actually you're going to encounter in the dungeon or the adventure area, but there's actually effects the DM can add in that will change how that scenario progresses. So again, it's really something aimed at if you just want to make the most powerful character imaginable within the constraints we give you, with each one we'll say, well, here's the level for your characters, and then just go up against a DM who's going to try his best to just slaughter the characters. This is really what that's aimed for. Our third Lair Assault will be coming out in March. And I don't know who wrote it. Some guy, Matt James, right here, wrote it. And it's called Attack of the Tyrant Claw. And that one, basically, we kind of go from a fire temple to pirates to the Isle of Dread. And I think there is this kind of a tower defense kind of aspect to it, where you have to build defenses as these dinosaurs come rushing out of the jungle to attack your camp. And so,
that's so awesome.
The author likes it, and you know it must be good. Right?
You guys did not approve my use of laser weapons.
So again, basically right. Coming up with almost like a puzzle for power gamers to solve. So. And then we have the product I was able to bring here today, the limited edition dragon set. Right, I'm going to show that off. This is the 5 chromatic dragons, including 2 new skulls. We have a new white dragon and a new green dragon. And this is coming out in October. And it's a lot like the Beholder set we released last year. It's got a limited edition collectible.
Very cool.
And we'll actually have this up here at the end of the presentation for you guys to check out the packaging and the actual minis. So then after that, while we segue into our next encounter season. So Neverwinter takes us to the end of the year. Or, I'm sorry, not all the way to the end of the year. It takes us to November. And then we head into the Feywild. So a lot like you said with Neverwinter, when we go into a new encounter season, we have a couple products that are sort of connected. In this case, we have player's option, here's the Feywild. There's a fortune card set that goes along with the season, and then the actual encounter season. The encounter season is based on the old UK1 module, Beyond the Crystal Cave. And one of the things we're emphasizing here is kind of like when I talked about Lair Assault, with each Lair Assault, we want to have a different challenge, different style of game. With each encounter season, we want to try to come up with a different theme, so things feel fresh. So with this encounter season, we're looking more for role play. There's a lot more encounters where you can talk your way past the Fae and whether strange creatures you meet, drawing on that the original module, and creating an adventure that feels a bit different. So it's not just the same thing with every season. With the player's option book, we're doing a couple interesting things. We hope excite you guys. For instance, we're introducing a player character race that can fly straight from the first level. You try to guess what Fae could do that. We also have a new barbarian build that is our first dual role character class. So the barbarian, when he's not raging, he's a defender. When he rages, he's a striker. So as a player, you can choose what kind of mode you want to send your character into. And that's an example of, as we start designing things, we really want to focus on, well, what's the most vivid way to make something come to life at the table, where you really feel like you're entering into a berserker fury, you know, throwing your shield aside and grasping your axe in both hands and just laying into a monster. And also with fortune cards, mechanical theme there, focus on Fae, that we have some extra benefits for characters who have a Fae background, so it kind of fits into the theme of the story and the Heroes of the Feywild book, where we give you a lot more Fae character options. So in December and then in March, we're adding to our Dungeon Tiles line. So one of the great things, last year we rolled out the three box sets of the Essential Dungeon Tiles, one for Dungeon, Urban, and Outdoors. We can now do sets that are a little more focused. We used to have to assume that with each set, well, it might be the first time someone buys some Dungeon Tiles, so we have to kind of cover a lot of the basic stuff. Well, now that we have those sets out there all the time, we keep them in print, we can afford to go a little more thematic. So our first one, Shadowgas Manor, that's releasing in December, and the idea behind it is the Haunted House. A crypt, a manor house, kind of playing up a specific theme. And then our March set, Cathedral of Chaos, this is actually, I think Peter Lee worked on this set. We actually were rolling out diagonal corridors. We want to build those old Gygaxian dungeons with the weird like room with like the eight passageways heading off, and like not a single one of the actual compass direction. This is what the set can do for you. So, and then we have a new type of product we're premiering in January, map packs. So this is a set of three double-sided poster maps. Some of these maps have appeared in specific adventures, and we're rolling them out again if you don't want to have to buy the adventure. And then one of them is, he'll have two new maps. It's three maps, and it is the same price as our Dungeon Tile sets, $11.95. So then we segue into our other December release, the Book of Vile Darkness. This is kind of like, it's not quite as deluxe as Madison Gardmore Abbey, but it is another way we're trying to give you guys more components, more interesting stuff to play with at the table. This book, so the original Book of Vile Darkness for 3.5, featured a lot on evil characters. Was it 3.0?
Yeah.
I was gonna, it was like, yeah. I still use it in 3.5, so. It's kind of ripping a little bit off of that in that it allows for playing evil campaign. So one of the things we wanted to approach with this was not just to give you a bunch of feats that made you evil or only evil characters could take, but also give the DM a lot of advice on, if you're going to run a campaign with evil characters, how can you do that in a way where the characters just don't fight, you know, fight each other or just try to kill each other constantly? So it's a way to make an interesting campaign based on characters who might be a little antagonistic toward each other or aren't exactly heroes. It's got a 32-page facsimile of the Book of Vile Darkness, so you can actually use that in play with your evil characters or your heroes trying to destroy it, and a 96-page book for the player and DM info, and a double-sided poster map. And then our next encounter season, kicking off in February, is based on elemental powers and enemies. So Power of the Plane Below, the player's option, Power of the Plane Below, that introduces elemental power options for characters. One of the things we're really excited about here is taking themes we rolled out originally in Dark Sun that we've spread out across a couple other books, and giving you a way you can integrate elemental power into any character by taking the appropriate theme. It also includes a new build for the monk, a monk that uses elemental power, and a new sort of essentialized version of the sorcerer, who's just a guy that just channels raw elemental power. We also have a set of fortune cards coming out, the Spiral of Therizdin. This kind of taps into the encounter season theme where you're dealing with a Therizdin-based conspiracy. These cards introduce some madness mechanics, some random effects that you might not really control that will hopefully help you but might not. And that also ties into the Elder Elemental Eye encounter season, where if the Feywild encounter season with the Beyond the Crystal Cave is a little more role-playing focused, this one is dealing more with investigation. It's probably not going as far as like Call of Cthulhu investigation, where you're finding stuff that just kills you. But the it is focusing a little more on putting together clues and trying to solve mysteries and move on the plot. So again, that's the kind of thing we really want to focus on with each encounter season. You feel like you're getting a really distinct story.
And that's tied to the climax of the Abyssal Plague novel series as well, with the Eye of the Chained God novel in April.
So now we're getting far enough out that I don't have too much to show you other than a poster map, which this is one of the most famous taverns of the Forgotten Realms. Can anyone name it? Exactly. We are doing an Undermountain adventure. So with the adventure pack, you get a poster map of the Yawning Portal, because obviously characters going to Undermountain will probably pass through the Yawning Portal at some time or another. It details 80 encounter areas in Undermountain, and it has three adventures. Now, the way the adventures are designed is that basically we give you Undermountain, we give you a poster map of it, we detail a lot of areas within it, then the adventures basically show you how the characters might get involved with something that sends them into the dungeon in search of something or dealing with some sort of plot. So it's really, again, it's kind of a DM's playground sort of approach. It gives you an environment to play with where you can just dungeon crawl if you want, or you can use one of these sort of preset stories that happens to take place in the encounter areas and dungeon map we've given you. There's a random dungeon generator you can use when the players inevitably go off the map and start wandering around. Dungeon is huge as Undermountain. It's impossible for us to map all of it. And there was also a poster map of the first level, and this map, I believe the poster map of the first level is on the reverse side of this map. So that basically wraps up RPGs. Undermountain comes out in April, so that's as far as we're showing off for right now. We want to focus on the encounter seasons. And do you guys have any questions about what we've shown you? Any question over here?
That elemental sorcerer you mentioned, is that going to be something to go alongside the PHP 2 and Arcane Power builds, or is it going to be a class compendium style replacement?
It'll go alongside. It'll be like the Slayer is to the fight to the PH1 fighter. So it's another type of build that goes far enough that we change some of the advancement. Otherwise, the monk, though, an example, is just it's a new build for the PH3 monk. Okay, so I'm going to go I'll just go up to here. So I'll try to make my way around the room. So
The third edition Book of Vile Darkness had a lot of really graphic stuff in it, a lot of really mature themes. Is the fourth edition one going to have the same tone as that, or is it going to be a little different?
It isn't quite the same level as the original. Like, we're not putting an adults-only sticker on it or anything like that. But it is done with Evil Campaign, so it's going to touch on some of those topics and themes. But the art's pretty much is standard for what we've been doing. Question here? Good question. The rituals. See, this is where it's tricky. As a manager, I didn't actually write most of these books, so rituals are something we've talked about. I do not believe rituals show up in Mordenkainen's. We have talked about. So the issue we see with rituals right now is that heroic tier people aren't getting much use out of them, and then once you have to higher level, you have enough money that especially the low level rituals, you can just start burning through cash and using as much as you want. So we have had some design discussions about how we could rectify that. What I would like to do ideally is we can just find a way to include new rituals that address that. So, for example, scaling rituals, a ritual that if you spend more money on it, gets more powerful, but you can make a small spend in components and gets a minor effect out of it. So, for example, like a knock style ritual where it may say, you know, you take the DC of the lock and roll a d20, and for every 50 gold you spend, you get an additional +1, you know, and it costs 25 base to use it, things like that. Also, some rituals that are faster to cast, so that knock isn't necessarily something that takes you an hour to do, but maybe more like a minute or 5 minutes. Something that's just long enough that you can't do it during a battle, but short enough that you could do it, say, if you're just trying to get out of a dungeon, or if you're exploring, or if you've sneaked into the evil temple and just need to get into a room that's locked. You're not like, okay, give me an hour, hopefully no one walks in here, and you can take a minute and get through. So, here?
I was just wondering about the e-books. Are they Kindle only?
No.
We
published e-books in three formats for Kindle, Nook, and Sony Reader. So they're on all the major, well, three out of four of the major platforms. Not in the Apple iBook store yet.
But is there a Kindle Reader for iBooks?
Yeah, you can use the Kindle app or the Nook app or the Kobo app on your iDevice to read them in those formats.
So I'm going to keep going backwards.
James, what's the price point on the e-books?
The MSRP is the same as the paperback, or, well, if a book is released in hardcover, that's the MSRP for the book and the ebook. The ebook retailers all discount that usually a significant amount. But when a hardcover release turns into a paperback release, the price is reduced accordingly.
But like, I would say, like for the re-releases, like Candle and stuff like that, like, is it all?
I believe it's. Give me a minute. Go on to the next question. I'll answer that in a second.
I'm looking it up, check your email, right? He said a question right back here. So the red shirt, the reddish shirt. Yeah, you just look back. Yeah.
The class builds and the Heroes of Feywild.
Heroes of Feywild. There is the barbarian new build. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, I was the lead designer on this. I don't know why Mike's not letting me talk about it. Like he knows, right? So we did have the barbarian build that Mike mentioned, which is the role shifting one. We have a new bard build in the book as well. That is focused on more of your sort of wandering scald type storyteller build. We have a new druid build in the book. We also have a lot of themes in the book. Well, I don't say a lot of things. We have some themes in the book that are focusing on things like you're one of the She-Lords, or you're an agent of the Unseelie Fae, or things like that that are really tied strongly into the story of the Feywild. Like, one of the things that we wanted to do with this book was make sure that when you build characters using this book, you have plenty of options for, okay, I'm a character from the Feywild, or I lived on the edge of a Fey crossing or something like that, and what does that mean for like my outlook on the world? What does that mean for how I act? And so I don't think it's a huge spoiler to say like the She-Lord theme gives you, since you're sort of a Ladrin nobility or something like that, gives you a permanent companion character that is just like, oh, he's one of the guards of your noble house and he follows you around, right? So things that really tie your mechanics in with the story of the Feywild.
Did you say the She-Lord was a permanent path?
It's a theme.
Sure.
Two question back here.
Yeah, usually announce like the next year campaign setting.
So usually when we take a new direction with a campaign setting or a new like playstyle thing like Neverwinter, that'll come up in August. We just aren't ready yet to start talking about that stuff. So this year we kind of intentionally pull things back a little bit. One of the things we've had in the past is we get too far ahead of ourselves. Like you just saw with Dungeon of Dread, where it's a board game. Now, and that's a little bit of an exception, but we get into a phase where we're talking about stuff before it's really ready, and we can actually show you guys, hey, what's exciting about this. That's something I really want to emphasize, is we have a little more information about the stuff, so we're not either creating expectations we can't meet, or there's just confusion about what's actually going on. I think in some ways with Essentials, that's something that we kind of learned, where we talk about it a lot, but we actually couldn't give you a lot of specific examples yet, because either we're still working on it, or it was just far enough out that things weren't settled for the actual design.
Right, but is that still something you want to do? Like,
oh, yes, yeah. Yeah. You know, we have a new campaign-style book coming out in August, so... Yeah, like basically like we showed with Undermountain, where we don't have a lot of final art yet, but that's something which is in final editing, and that's good to go. Like that's a project we are 100% go on. So. Undermountain is coming out in, I believe it's March. I always am terrible with dates.
April.
No, April, sorry.
So I looked up Homeland in the Kindle store. The MSRP is $7.99. Amazon sells it for $6.39. Basically, it's on par with our other paperbacks.
Question back here.
Hey, Mike, could you talk about D&D Insider for a bit and the fate of the virtual table? Lots of hope, and I talk about it every year. I ask about it every year. Could you give us some hope or some ideas in the development design resources for that?
So that's a little tricky, because basically in R&D we handle game design, and anything digital is a completely separate team. What I do know is that with the table, we are still in beta. We're still sending out invites. We're still bringing in people. A lot of it is, and this kind of gets back to what I was talking about earlier, we don't want to get ahead of ourselves. We want to make sure that when we're up here saying, and this is what it is, and we're ready to go, that we are ready to go. So it's a complex process. It's something really new for the company, and we want to make sure that we roll it out officially and it's good to go, that it's perfect. So
Insider is healthy, and it's going to keep going. I mean, the builder, I think, is the best it's ever been.
Oh, yeah, we have actually on Thursday we had a seminar talking about DDI and content coming out. So, for example, one of the things we're doing, and I believe it's the October issue, is we're doing character
you know, we want to do some theme articles there, setting stuff that we might not be able to support through a print book, where it's like, well, we don't know if the interest is there, if enough people to get excited about it, but we can cover it in Insider, in Dragon and Dungeon. We're also looking at doing more different adventure formats, and we've rolled out some of that, showing how we're going to do different adventures. And things like the Strength Cleric powers we released, I think, now about 2 months ago. There's something there where you can just kind of look out in the forums and look at the questions you guys are asking us and say, you know what, here's a class that needs some help, or here's something that needs some more powers, or people asking for this type of adventure, like epic tier support, things like that. We know we've got a lot of demand for that. So it's something where we can take a few more risks and be a little more targeted in what we're delivering for content. Because with digital, like with a print book, so I'll give you an example, like Waterdeep, I think we finished design on that. That's a board game, bad example. Undermountain, the design finished probably about 2 months ago. So just with our production times, it moves very slowly, and it turns even slower. Where with digital, we can have an idea and implement it and get it done in about a 3-month span. And that includes editing, development, playtesting, and everything. So that's really the advantage that gives us, and we see that as a really important outlet. Because it gives us, you know, if print kind of moves slow, and you kind of notice too, with we're doing fewer print releases, but we're putting more stuff into it, making them more deluxe. There's kind of this idea of, you know, when James talks about ebooks and stuff, where as things get more digital, I think what we're seeing, we're kind of trying to work around is this idea of digital is where you go for more things, I don't want to say disposable, but more just kind of impulsively pick up, smaller things, you know, a kind of a paperback style thing as opposed to a nice hardcover, where if you're buying something physical, maybe want something a little more deluxe, a little more luxurious, something where you're more going to think, hey, I want to keep this, you know, 10 years from now, I still want to have this on the shelf, and I can pull it out and use the poster maps, the tokens, or use the adventure, something I get a lot of use out of that you're really going to value. So we think there's kind of that dichotomy that's growing up, where, you know, in the 80s, you have a 32-page adventure would be kind of the standard thing you bought. See that stuff kind of going more digital now. And the more physical products are things that are a little more, I don't want to say collectible, because I think that kind of casts a different shine on it. The things that are more memorable, things that are a little more, I don't want to say luxury either, because it's not like we're selling Fabergé eggs, but that kind of feel. Yeah, I really do like it. So we got, I'm going to go around this way, so let's go right back there. Yep.
I'm wondering, is there any plan to create game products or maybe even just utilize the Abyssal Plague element? It's a really interesting idea in the novels, and I don't know if there's going to be any game product support or something like that.
We've actually had some DDI articles.
Yes, we had some DDI articles. The first appearance of stats for some of the Abyssal Plague demons appeared in the Monster Vault Threats to the Nandir Vale box set or slipcover thing. What?
James was nodding.
Yes. Then we had some DDI articles following up. I'm blanking on who wrote those because it was somebody that I know.
Mike Shea.
That started out some more of the types of demons as well as some of the bosses. And the encounter season for next spring is going to tie into the conclusion of that series. The Spiral of Thursday.
So I'll go back here and I'll work my way back over.
All
right. Oh, sorry, the quarterback.
You've started putting more tokens into some of your products. Has it occurred to you that you might want to put tokens out for all of your monsters?
So, yeah, it's one of the things we did with the Monster Vault. Basically, our attitude is when we put a monster in a print product, if possible, and, like, well, we want to make it possible, but there's a token for it. We've talked about maybe... So if we did a set of just tokens, kind of like we do tiles, how many people here would buy it?
That's a pretty good number.
Yeah, that's a good question, right? $500 right now. I only need to sell one. No,
Dungeon tiles are a good comparison because it's the same.
Yeah,
it's more or less the same paper stock.
Exactly. So it'd be about $10-$12 in that price range.
I'll tell you right now, if you could have something like the Essentials Monster Ball Part 2, I'll buy 3.
Well, we do have the Nentir Vale Vault is essentially that.
Exactly. So if you
guys keep those,
I'll buy them.
Right. Good to know. So back here, I'm going to come up to you. I'm sorry, so right here, start with the white. Yep, lanyard. Yep, right there. Sorry, no, with the guy behind you. Sorry.
Two white
both had white lanyards.
You know, I'm just going to talk. I just want to let you guys know, I'm the one guy who wants to play the Rune Priest so high.
Thank you. I designed the Rune Priest. So.
You know what? Should I just commission additional content directly from you guys?
Actually.
I'll write it for him.
If you could cut me a $100 check, I can guarantee that in the October issue with our Oriental Adventures content, there'll be a, we didn't say kanji exactly, but there is a new Rune Priest build coming out.
They announced kanji.
Yeah, okay, so we have announced that. Yep, so there is a new build coming out. So
So yeah, I would have tried to get money out of you, but it's too late. We've already done it. I could threaten to stop it, though. I'll take it hostage, right?
Mike,
hostage.
Mike, don't tweet that.
Yeah, exactly.
I've got basically the same question on the Seeker.
Yeah, so the Seeker, so same thing. So when we take those classes, so basically we have with DDI, we have this huge database. Well, not huge. We have a huge database that we get a small spreadsheet out of that says what people are playing. So it kind of goes back to what I was talking about Epic Play, where for a class that we just don't see as many people playing, we want to be a lot more careful about how we support it, because clearly there's something where people, it's not connecting with people in some way. So we want to go back and figure out a way. We don't want to just release more powers. So what we want to do is find a way, is there something we do thematically, like we're doing with the Rune Priest, where we can tie it into the... Now, I don't think we actually could call it Kanji, because I think it's a name for the alphabet in Kawatur, but tie it into something like that, where there is more of a flavor behind it, where maybe the story element's there or a different type of mechanic that's integrated into the existing character class to make it a little more interesting, a little more appealing. So that's definitely something when we see the top class, it's easier for us. We wanted to, I mean, if we just strictly said the most popular thing gets all the mechanics, we would just do nothing but stuff for here. Well, the human fighters, actually, they're number one. But yeah, warlocks is tricky because designers love warlocks. When they used to do a lot of 3-5 work, you'd always get lots of stuff for monks, because people like designing feats for monks, and so the monk got a lot of stuff. But so it's something we have to kind of manage. A lot of one of the drawbacks, too, is since, especially in the magazines, it's driven by submissions. Since those classes aren't getting necessarily played a lot, we don't necessarily get a lot of submissions for those classes. So what happens is, let's say for a warlock article, it's a great example, we might get 100 pitches for the warlock when we have the open window, because everyone can think of a pack or a different flavor of it. So out of those 100, if 1% are, you know, hey, we want to print, there's your article. If we get, like, 5 Seeker articles, but you're still sitting, like, at a 1 to 5%, hey, this is really what we want to do because we get so many submissions, it's just that much harder for it. So we actually, when we're looking at those classes, are being very directed in what we want to do with them, as opposed to the more popular classes where we can just kind of afford to see what comes in and take the best of the best. So, and once we say, hey, we want to do this internally, it just takes more time because we're just juggling projects and making sure that we're doing it right. We don't want to say, hey, Seeker players, here's some more stuff for you, and they just say, eh, you know, it's still not quite what we want, so.
Trevor. Hey, Mike, so, I got a question.
Sure.
It's for you and Robin. So we've got the spectrum of, you know, AEDU classes and the different kinds of classes that were released in Essentials. People were asking what the new barbarian build and the skull type build were going to be.
Both of those, actually, yeah, both of those use the they have at wills and counters and daily powers, but there are some twists.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
So
that's one thing that we looked at. So for example, when we looked at the monk came in from the designer, designed a lot like some of the Essentials classes with more features and repeatable encounter power. And we went back and said, you know what, the monk is a PH3 class. We don't have a lot of support for it compared to other classes. We want to see this written in a way where it is using the full power structure. So even if anyone playing a monk can take all of these powers and is getting the same structure. So typically when we do a class like the sorcerer, we say, okay, we want to do something a little bit different. We want to have a class that has a fair amount of support for it already in its original PH form. Where if we want to kind of start changing things, like making an encounter power used multiple times or more class feature driven instead of powers, that the original class has a lot of support. So, for example, with the Seeker, we wouldn't want to take the Seeker and create a new version that just had a completely different power scheme or was just driven by class features. So that's something we want to balance there. So
those classes will have, I mean, you can twist between class features, a lot of interesting class features. Are they going to get them like at progressive levels like we kind of did with some of the essential stuff?
I don't really know how to answer that.
Okay, no worries.
At this point. All I can say is that, you know, one of my goals with Heroes of the Feywild specifically, and I'll talk about Heroes of the Feywild because I was the designer of that. One of my goals was for it to be as sort of tied to the flavor as possible and also as useful as possible. When it comes to things like the Bard and the Barbarian, which are players have up two classes and don't have the level of support like the Cleric or the Fighter has, it's a little bit more important to make sure that that's useful to a broader spectrum of people. So, yeah, you'll see, you know, a more traditional structure with us.
Cool. So, let's see, question back here, right next to the guy who asked about the Seeker. Sorry. Yeah.
Neverwinter is not a box set. Is that correct?
That's right. It's, yeah, it's a book.
What drove you to do that as a book? If you're going to have both player and DM content, it's kind of one of my pet peeves that you have both in the same book. unfortunately tempt the player to kind of dig deeper into the DM stuff. It seemed like if you were going to box it, you could actually do two separate books, and then you could hand the player book to the players.
So what we try to do, and this is something we're kind of learning as we go, because this is a transition point for us. Typically for a book, which we say, hey, here's an encounter season and here's the resource for it, we like to do a book because it's more portable. If people are bringing it to the encounter session. And it's something where it's more text-driven. We don't want to get into the mode of doing component stuff. It's kind of gimmicky. So we want to make sure it's something. So usually, typically, for something that's going to include a lot of player content, we want to go with a book format. Book of Wild Arcs is a little bit different since it doesn't tie into an encounter season. If it does not tie into encounter season, we want to make it something a little more interesting, a little more deluxe, where you could do that as kind of maybe a one-shot or a different kind of campaign, your evil campaign. But if it's something that we kind of see people getting a lot of use of out of the table, that's when we go for a hardcover book. So really, it also just saves wear and tear and everything. So now, that doesn't mean we won't do that in the future, but I mean, just for right now, that's how we're looking at kind of doling out that content. So what's the question? Let's see, I'll go up here. And then, sorry, yep, right there, yeah.
In my group, gaming groups, there seems to be a lot of confusion over the new class progression that came out when I get to Essentials or whatever.
Yeah.
Is everybody I'm playing with is playing with the old PHB classes? Someone tried to create like a vampire or something because they think it's a cool idea, and they get in there, and then everybody's confused all of a sudden because it's like different enough to create a lot of confusion. And I was wondering if there's any resources or something available that, other than just like online or something, that would say, hey, this is what's changed, this is how you translate.
Oh, sure.
You know what I mean?
So the best way to approach those classes is to assume when we give you a new character class, everything you need is right there in the text, including, if it's different, an advancement table. So if the class does not have a table that shows you its advancement by tier, that means you're going to use the original, the AEDU advancement chart from PH1 and PH2.
Okay.
So if you notice in PH3, for example, when we did psionics, I believe in that book, we updated the charts. So here's how the psionic classes and where you're swapping up powers and how those work a little bit differently. So generally, if you have a book in front of you and you're saying, hey, how does this class work? Start in the class description, look for the table there. If there's no table there, then look for the first chapter of the book that should have the table there. If it's not there, then go back to the PH1.
Okay.
So that's the best. That's the best way to work through that.
Okay.
This question right here.
Me?
Oh no, sorry. Directly behind you.
Okay.
Sorry, I keep getting people
sorry,
right behind
sorry,
you.
On your setting, you got coming out next August. Is there any kind of hint that you can give? Like, is it a new setting or something old that's being redone?
Oh, that's
or
a. I'm trying to think of how much I can tease about someone and Brand yelling at me.
Is that with lances and dragons?
It does not have lances or dragons. That's something that which I'm a big fan of dragons.
A setting without dragons in D&D?
Yeah.
It has dragons.
Oh, it does. It could have dragons. That's right. So what we want to do with the I'll tease this. I won't say anything story wise because what we do is, especially like with Neverwinter, we want to kind of create an entire thing around it where it's really exciting, kind of the reveal and all that stuff. But I will say this, it's not just a setting, but it's a way to play. There's going to be something different in which we kind of show you a little bit different twist on D&D, something that D&D really hasn't tried before, but once you see what we're doing, it'll all make absolute sense. So
twist is a good word.
Yeah.
Oh.
Sorry, now we're good.
Yes, I would like to know what kind of racial options are there, and can you tell us more about this winged
fae? Do you want to give them the? Do you ever list the races?
Should I just tell them the races?
Yeah, tell them.
Okay, I'm just going to tell you the races because it's not that easy. So the races in here is the Feywild are the Hamadryad, the Satyr, the Pixie. That's it.
I think those three.
Yeah,
there's three. So yeah, we're doing and obviously Pixies are the race that can fly. So in a race that we
know, it's the Satyrs.
Yeah, Satyrs. Yeah. Hey. That is exactly. Actually, the trick is they think they can fly. They actually can't. They're just running. That's why they have the horns and they crash.
So in addition to that, I will also say that there is support for a variety of different races tied to the Feywild.
What kind of
drive
did you say that was?
Hamadryad.
Question right here.
Hammer Dryad!
Can you elaborate a little bit more on you mentioned the use of elements and a wizard that uses elements. Can you elaborate a little bit more on that? Is that, can they use all elements, or can they only specialize in earth or air?
So one of the things we want to do for the actual, like, saying this is an element I'm really strongly tied to, that's where the themes come into play. The sorcerer, since it's kind of a
simplified version of the class really focuses on one element as like this is the primary thing they deal with. And then otherwise, what we want to do with the wizard is make things very useful across the board, so elemental theme powers, and that you can sort of dip into as much as you want. Kind of like the, on Dragon, we had the Pyromancer build last year, which gave you benefits for using fire spells, but it didn't cut you off from other options. So you can create a theme guide, but you're not getting so locked in that you can't do other things.
Hey, Mike. Is this true? You didn't talk about this.
Oh, that's right. There's a Shire build for the PH1 wizard. So... Sorry, I completely blanked on that. It's Saturday morning. I'm still not actually awake yet because it's still 7 a.m. back home. So, so there is a Shire build, and that'll work with the PH1 wizard.
Wait, hold on a second. Does anybody not know what a Shire is? Yeah, that's what I thought.
Oh, kids these days.
Yes, so back in 2nd edition, my favorite campaign setting of all time, Akadim. The Arabian Adventure themed campaign setting featured the Shire, which is a wizard that has a genie familiar that goes out and gets him spells for him instead of a spell book. And Al-Kadim is awesome, and I don't care what anybody says.
Yeah, and actually, that's someone just saying we should bring back Al-Kadim. That's the kind of setting we would definitely want to do in Dragon and Dungeon first, see if there's interest, and then lead up. So that's one of the great things. It lets us, we can focus on, say, one campaign setting per year in print. But online, we have a lot more flexibility to start delving into stuff. Like maybe Dragons and Lances. I don't know. That's still set, right? We haven't even figured out our schedule for next year for that. So, question right up here.
The Legends and Lore articles. Where are we going with that?
So,
wow, it took like 30 minutes before somebody asked that. That's good.
So, this is one of the things with my new job. I am just a manager now. I don't design anything. Like, I like to tell people, if I have to design something, something's gone seriously wrong, and it's probably something that I've screwed up, because I either didn't give people enough time to do something, or what. I'm not a designer anymore. I don't actually write stuff unless I want to, or unless someone's like, oh my god, they're at the gates, they're screaming for more strength cleric powers, Merles, get out there and give them some, right? And that's when it's just okay, get out there and do it, right? I always have these visions, like the way our office, it's like this big flash cube, and there's this main driveway heading up is a circle. And I've always pictured like Rune Priest players when they're just gathering and just pouring out with protest signs. It's just
both of them.
In the defense, there's like a lot more of this. Within the, there's like all these tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of D&D players. There'd probably be like 1,000 of them out there. So that's the tricky thing. But there'd be enough that we wouldn't be able to escape the building alive. So we would probably give them their contact.
They're fast zombies.
So anyways, now I'll just go to the next question. No, wait, sorry. Exactly. So in my new role, I am basically like the guy on top of the mountain trying to figure out like what's going on down there, right? Like seeing things, this very big picture. And what that gives me the luxury of doing is we're a research and development department, or it's research and design, or research and danger. I always forget what the D is. But it just lets me start thinking, where could we be? You know, I like to say, like, game design or anything creative, kind of think of D&D, it's like this amusement park, and it's, you know, there's all these different paths you can go on to get to different rides and stuff. It's like, and it's all kind of wooded, so you can't really see necessarily where you're going. There's a sign that might say where a path goes, and you kind of follow it. And our job is research and development is to say, look, there's other paths out there. We just haven't built them yet. We have to find them, right? And we can't rely on players just kind of stumble through the woods and find something cool or come up with it themselves. We have to try to lead that charge. But on the other hand, this is a lesson we've learned the hard way many times, and I've seen it learned, and keeping it in mind as I go forward, you can't just push people into the woods and say, this will be fun, right? And they hate it, right? And that's not a good idea. So anytime, and this is actually, I'm going to let you know a little secret, we have something else we need to talk about. It's not related to the RPG, so it's not 5th edition, don't worry. But we have one other thing we're going to talk about before this session ends.
You doing that now?
Say what? No, not right now. Oh. No, don't go. But now no one's going to want to know, to see it. I kind of think it's almost like, if you're in charge, it's kind of like being elected to office. Right, like I'm not an emperor. I just can't go out and say, "And you want to play Dragonlance and enjoy it," right? Because people can just rebel and say, "Well, I'm not going to buy your products. Your sales will tank, and then you're fired." Right. So instead, what we need to get back into the mode of is looking at what people are doing with D&D, looking at what people want out of D&D, and looking at what's really going to excite them. You know, I think there's kind of two ways we can do products that I think will actually work. We can do things we just kind of listen and say, "Hey guys, this is the way you guys want to go. This is the feedback we're getting. We're going to go that way." And then we can also do things where we kind of surprise you and say, hey, here's something really interesting. But if we do any major changes to the game, we can't do it in the surprise kind of way. I kind of likened it, and this, I got a lot of flack for it, deservedly so, but I'll drag it up anyway. Right. It's kind of like someone, like you babysit someone's like 6-month-old and decide, let's do a little plastic surgery on the kid while we're away, because I think this kid could use some improvement. And it's just like, that's disgusting and crazy and weird, and just gets people really like, why would you do that, right? So instead, what you'd want to do is like, hey, I swept your house while you were away, or, you know, I did your laundry. Oh, that's a pleasant surprise, you know? There's a certain bound you can navigate in and surprise people. So really, with Legend Lore Column, I'm just kind of musing on those kind of paths I think might be out there. And I'm seeing what people tell me back. I mean, if you've read, and who here has been reading the column? Okay, wow, okay. So, all right, so and if you notice, when I write them, I usually spend the first paragraph talking about, I go through the forums, I read all the stuff, even the stuff people saying, who's that Merle's jerk, fire him, right? Which is actually, I think it's actually my wife, but I'm not sure. I reread all that stuff, you read everything. Like, I made myself, when I got this job, I made myself go back to the 4th edition Player's Handbook and read every single 1-star review of the book. And then I made myself read every 5-star review, because clearly there are people who love 4th edition, but there are clearly people who are unhappy. And to me, that's just like, it's kind of weird when you think, like, well, here's Dungeons & Dragons, and you guys all like Dungeons & Dragons, well, why are some of you here and really excited about Dungeons & Dragons? There's a lot of people here who would be excited about Dungeons & Dragons, except they're over at the Pathfinder thing right next door, right? So what's going on there? What's happening? And I think in some ways, you know, I think back to the 80s and 90s when I was a fan, long before I got this job, I used to think of TSR as kind of like this Shangri-La, right? Where I knew who Roger Moore was, I knew who Doug Niles was, I knew who these guys were, and I trusted them to do good stuff. And then when things kind of changed, and we kind of went into second edition, I kind of felt like I didn't really know who these guys were anymore, who were doing this stuff. And when I'd buy adventures and books, they didn't really speak to how I played D&D. And it almost kind of felt like someone was like, in Lake Geneva, was wagging their finger at me saying, oh no, this is how you're supposed to play D&D. You're supposed to talk in funny voices, and if you like dungeon crawls and exploring, you're doing it wrong. And that really rankled me, you know, to the point where I stopped playing D&D for quite a while. And then eventually I came back into the game with 3rd edition, because there's something about 3rd edition that made me go, this is right, they've got it right, this is D&D, this is it. And I worry sometimes with 4th edition, we did kind of something similar, where we just kind of started lecturing people on, this is how you're going to do it, and whether you like it or not, this is D&D now. And I think that's not a good idea for anything that's creative. Like, obviously it's creative for us, we write stuff, but it's creative for you guys too. I mean, you guys are creators. And creators, I mean, we have the internet, we have all these outlets, but we're a vanishing species, you know, and D&D has to be something that serves the creators. The RPG, I mean, you can play a board game, that's a little bit different, but the RPG has to be something that serves that creative impulse. And if we're missing on it, you know, you guys aren't passive consumers. You're not just going to sit back and let us give you whatever it is we're trying to hand out. You guys are, I mean, not to like, hey, D&D fans, but you guys expect more. You know, because you are creating stuff, whether it's making a character, making an entire campaign setting, or making an adventure, you're much more intellectually engaged with this game than any other game, except maybe something like chess, where people are playing competitively and are just studying the hell out of it. But even then, on that creative level, it's just different. So we can't afford to try to dictate to you guys, because you're too smart for that. What we need to do is communicate with you guys and have a dialogue and come to an understanding and really get back to the roots of what made D&D great. And get back to the roots of that trust that exists between the guys who currently hold on to D&D and the guys who really are in charge of the game. That's you, right? At the end of the day, if you guys decided that you hated everything we were publishing, we'd go away. But you guys would still be here playing D&D. And that'd be true forever. So, like, it's in one of my Legends of Lore column, I had a quote from Gary Geiger. He said, you know, the thing, we've got to make sure the DMs never figure out they don't need us. And I think you guys have figured that out. Like, it doesn't take much to figure out, because I did that back in 1990-91. Was like, I love Greyhawk. You guys are kind of not really supporting it. You're doing adventures that I think are kind of insulting to the setting. I don't need you anymore. I got my dice and a pad of graph paper and a notebook, and that's all I need to play D&D. So for us to remain relevant, we have to try harder than ever. We have to work harder than ever, and we have to regain that trust. So a lot of that is with Legends and Lore, is trying to get that trust back. And I said, this is what we're thinking of. And when you guys tell us stuff back, not just saying, oh, you talked to us, isn't that great? Look, 100 people commented, that's great. Yeah, all 100 are saying we hate this, right? So that's really bad. Like, let's not do this. It's getting back to that sense of where you guys know we're listening to you, and hopefully if we can do that, then you will want to listen to us. So I'm going to loop back around this way, right here.
Is there any plans for a digital distribution of the core manual?
Oh, like Player's Handbook and such? We are looking at some of that stuff, but again, we don't have anything to announce yet. So, but we are definitely aware of how people The PDF thing is a great example of something where it just kind of got pulled. The people obviously weren't very happy. So we are definitely aware of that, and we're trying to, we are looking at ways we can make you guys happy. So, good dear.
Two questions related to the Narath board game. Since you guys have had more time to have experience with it, is there any likelihood of seeing additional start scenarios?
Think about Conquest of Narath?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, Conquest of Narath is one of those games that we really want to look hard at how we would do expansions on it, because it is, you know, it's a pretty big, heavy investment game, right? It's a big $80 board game, and the people that, you know, buy it and get into it really, really get into it, but it's pretty daunting to other people. And so I'm not sure I want to follow the same route that we do with, like, the Castle Ravenloft and say, oh, you want to expand your game? Well, buy this other $80 game, right? So,
my closet will fill up very fast.
Right, and plus it's a huge box, right? So, haven't got any solid plans on that, but it's definitely something we're looking at because there has been really, really positive fan response from that. I will say this, that there's some great fan stuff being created right now, so if you're looking for additional content, check out any like fan forums, like Board Game Geek or the Wizards forums, because there's some really, really cool fan expansions being done for it. And I'm sitting there going, oh, I like that. I'm going to use that in my game. So.
Question is, has there been any thought to taking some of the mechanic from that game for mass battle rules to roll into the main game?
I don't know
if the game specific. So I know this when I was looking at it, I was like, these 15mm, like, it was just, like, I like the little figures. Like, this is kind of cool. If I could, like, use these as my miniatures and just put them in my pocket. Not that we'd do that, because it would change the scale and everyone would justifiably kill us. But but it kind of think, like, how could we do something that is that would integrate? I don't know if we would use those exact mechanics. I don't know, Roddy, is that something you guys...
So we really like that system, obviously. And it's something we want to explore for other games. I don't know that we'd necessarily do it for, like, a mass battles game tied to the RPG. But it's something we definitely want to look at using again. I will also say, just straight up front, we are also looking at ways to do a mass battles game as well.
So I'm going to go right down here.
Oh, yeah. Can we do more support for other eras, for eras and for fourth edition, like sci-fi, whatever?
Not right now. We really want to focus on D&D at the moment. You know, just really get that. Really focus on D&D. I think one of the things, Rodney mentioned, we used to talk about the adventure game system. How with each game we've done, we've gotten better at it. And I think that the Legend of Drizzt, not to toot our horn, but I think it's the best one in the series so far. So I really want to focus on getting back to the basics of what we do and improve there before we start getting too ambitious and going beyond fantasy. So, question right here.
Heroes of Shadow is heavily tied to the Shadow Power Source, of course. Plane Below seems to be tied to the Elemental.
Yep, that's correct, Elemental, yeah.
Feywild, is it Primal or is it...
It's a mix, yeah.
It's mostly arcane, because the Feywild is... sorry, when I talk about Feywild, I'm talking about specifically the plane, the Feywild. It's heavily tied into the arcane power source, because it is the realm of magic, it's the home of the Eladrin, et cetera, et cetera. That said, there is also a strong primal tie, because the Feywild is also this sort of primeval, untouched landscape, but the primal spirits in D&D are typically tied more strongly with the natural world, so... it's more like you'd be looking at some sort of fringe primal element sneaking in to the Feywild.
So go right down here.
Not to run into one of those butt contingencies, and I don't want to sound too criticizing.
That's fine.
But to relate to the Runefleet priest and I guess the class that I love, the assassin, which has a ton of flavor to it, but in terms of abilities, it's pretty lackluster in terms of feat support and abilities, but when you look at like a class like a fighter or a wizard, there are like five different builds.
Yep.
So you have five different options. When you look at the assassin, you look at the core options like to grant temporary hit points versus non-bloody, or you know the damage option when you're not adjacent to an ally. It's really kind of crappy, so it's easy for people to overlook this stuff.
Yeah.
So you get into the cycle of, okay, what am I going to play? I see a fighter, I see all these sweet build options, or a wizard. I mean, you can compare a wizard and a sorcerer, because you can build a wizard to be just as good as a sorcerer in terms of damage, but have way more options. And I was wondering if you had any plans of, I guess, looking at classes like the Rune Priest and the Assassin, because when the Essentials came out, I thought there'd be additional feat support, and when looking at the feats, I mean, to be honest, yeah, they were okay, but most of them kind of suck. And so you laugh,
Mike,
because you probably agree with it.
I don't know if I'd agree with it. So a lot of the things, the confusion, a lot of the feats and essentials are really just designed to work alongside the sort of point of that product, which is to create a new on-ramp for the game. So what we want to do is, when we look across the board at power, like, we definitely pay attention to the character optimization forms and see where we're hitting. The hard thing for us, though, is we can't pay so much attention to the one end of power that we lose track of the whole continuum. So it's sort of a balancing act. Because what we could do is we could just come out and we could look at the math and just say, here's an assassin option that's just the best, right? Like, now the guy is better than everyone else. So it's a little bit of a hard balancing act, because we also don't want to come across as, well, you know, any imbalances are accidental. But essentially, you could kind of say, well, shouldn't, you know, if you look at all the classes and there's a bunch of classes, if this is power, here are the powerful classes, here are the weak classes, we could just shove the guys over here. And in some ways, that's kind of like, oh, that just, as a designer, like, I don't know if that's a good idea, but in some ways that might be something we need to do. So I guess what I'm saying is there are no options we've taken off the table. That's why I kind of get back to saying we're looking at, when using internal, like, designers in-house to work on this stuff, it's just going to be a little bit slower because we're working on a lot of the print stuff. We can't be as agile as we normally are. As opposed to, say, doing stuff for the strength cleric, where we've written a lot of strength cleric stuff, and we have a really clear view on exactly what we need to deliver. So, but it's definitely a concern we have, because we don't want entire classes getting pushed out. And it goes back to what I was saying before about, once a class gets thrown on the edge, we stop getting as many we start getting as many submissions, or spend more time on it, and it's just a matter of balancing all that.
Well, do you have any plans in any of the upcoming magazines to maybe address some of those not as commonly played classes in feat selections?
So one of the things we did early in the summer was Steve Winter started a thread on the forums. We basically said, what isn't working in the game? And we took all of that feedback, and we have a giant list now. Basically, it's our to-do list. Now, I can't promise you what order we're going to get to that stuff, because we have a lot of stuff going on, but we have that list, and we're working through it. So.
Okay, thanks. Cool.
I was just wondering, how much playtesting goes into this? Because, with the new books, has it changed over time? Because, with the original core books, they're entirely useless now. You wouldn't bring them to D&D because you would need to bring, the binder with all your errata. And some of the books have quite a bit of errata other than that.
Well, yeah, and this is what I talked about. I mean, I don't know if I go as far as say it's useless, but we are. But people have that impression, and so in a lot of ways, what's the impression? That's the impression. We need to work on that. So that's why I talk about. We have Greg Bills, and we have a set of playtesters. I want to say there's about 100 people. Greg came to the store, but he went up to legal with all the NDAs. They were just kind of mad because there's a giant stack of people who were NDAing. So that is something we're specifically looking at, is getting a lot more playtesting done on these books. When we're doing fewer books in the schedule. I mean, there are years when we'd get up and we'd have 3 books per month, and that's a strategy you can do if you're just like, let's just throw as many books out there as possible, and we have a nice big revenue number, don't we look successful? But really, you're just hitting the wall of low quality, but lots of stuff. I don't want to be in that business, because at the end of the day, that's not going to get you anywhere. So that's one of the things we're focusing on, with fewer books, a lot more playtesting, a lot more attention paid to them.
Sure.
I want to
talk about the encounter seasons. I mean, there's me and another guy in our store that have kind of been DMing every week, and they've actually been getting, I mean, they've been getting a lot better from season to season, so I've been really enjoying that. It's bringing in new people and stuff. That's cool. But the only thing is this week, I mean, it's the end of the season, and neither of us are there. We're there this Wednesday because we came here.
Yeah.
But I'm lucky that there was somebody else who just recently started coming and said, yeah, I'll go ahead and try it out this week. So, and I actually got a call, and I guess it went pretty well. But is there any kind of plans maybe to kind of plan in some type of breaks in there? For these types of Gen Con, EDXP, those weeks where the people who are maybe running might not be there or have a hard time being there and coming here.
Yeah. So one of the things we've talked about is including some weeks for character creation. So that can be a week where you don't have to have a DM, something you just do, a couple people can get together and make characters. Chris Tulak has a seminar. Is that seminar today, the Playing D&D?
Yesterday.
It was yesterday.
So we had the OP seminar yesterday.
Oh, okay. So he would know a lot more about the specifics of that, but I know it's something we've talked about is building in some breaks, like Thanksgiving, holidays.
Yeah.
We don't expect people on Christmas Day to show up, and I mean, well, okay, not everyone celebrates Christmas, but it's still enough people are getting, you know, would not want to go to their store or the store's closed that day to play encounters. Yeah.
Something like that, yeah. We just had, nobody showing up. I was showing up just in case somebody showed up and nobody there because it was like a holiday.
The challenge we faced with encounters when it first started was like, well, here's a way for people who haven't played D&D to start playing D&D. And we didn't expect to still be doing it necessarily 2 years later or a year and a half later. Okay. So it's definitely something where we're looking at how we're doing it, and it kind of gets back to when we trim back the schedule and put more focus on products. We can spend more time now going back and looking at things we've already done and trying to find the best ways to do those. Quest right here.
Anything mini related beyond the dragon?
We'll get to that. The Weston's here.
I just question on the. You mentioned there's going to be a strong investigative component. That's going to be kind of a theme of one of the upcoming arcs.
Yeah, the Elder Elemental Eye. Yeah.
Right. Is that? Would you describe that as providing examples of how the current system supports investigative, say, skill challenges? Or is it going to involve new mechanics that elaborate on the existing model for investigation or other types of skill challenges?
So in the case of something like this for an encounter season, we want to keep it generally, try to keep it simple for the DMs. We would be using skill challenges. Now, those skill challenges, they might be designed in a way that's a little different, but we want to focus on using established mechanics. The idea is if a DM just kind of shows up, it's like, hey, we need a DM, can you run this? We don't say, oh, now before you start, read these two or three pages of rules to figure out how to use this new system. So that's something where if we did something like that, sorry, we'd probably do it more in a dungeon adventure where we know the DM's
going to tie into Dungeons & Dragons to support this theme so that people could take that theme and move it into their home campaign.
Yeah, that's something where for something specific like that, we might not... usually for the encounter seasons, we... try to put all the character support in the book that goes along with it so that people are pretty clear, like, hey, I have this book, this is what I'm using. They don't have to go back and forth. But that's something which we could do, say, in a issue theme for Dragon and Dungeon, like we did with Carateur, where you get some character options. There's an option, there's an Unearthed Arcana article on an honor system, kind of like the AD&D system for accruing honor and losing it. So that's something where if we did an investigative kind of thing, like what were the guys in Eberron, the investigative?
Inquisitives.
Yeah, so we want to do, we want to do something that, not saying it's on the schedule, but as an example, we could do a theme issue on Eberron that focuses on Inquisitives and doing mystery-style adventures, and that would have a similar, it would have like an Unearthed Arcana article to go along with it, so. So, question right there.
Are you planning on bringing more of the classes from like the 3.5 series like the invocation theme classes or the
swashbuckler? Something like that, I think we'd look at supporting via a theme or by taking existing powers and abilities for a class and showing you how you can use those with like a theme or a few feats to create a similar effect. Because this goes back to the rune priest issue and the seeker issue. I think we've hit the point where if we keep doing too many new classes, we're going to end up with unhappy players. We don't want people to be like, hey, it's a new class, I opt into it, and then, well, where's the support for it? Like,
there's
the assassin.
More
like,
classes until I get two more
rune
priest
builds. Yeah. I think that's fair, right? We want to make sure that, like, you know, we can't keep adding stuff and then not supporting stuff. So we want to make sure. And that's why when I kind of talked about with the monk and the elemental power book, instead of making a new, wholly new build, essential style build for the monk, we said, no, let's go back and just make this a new build for the existing monk. Let's focus on support now rather than just adding a lot of new stuff. Now that's kind of a later change. The Elemental Power Book is where that first shows up, but that's something which we want to prioritize as we move forward. So,
Artificer just
My point is going to be on something you just touched on that, on not producing like additional classes without for that whole issue of there's not enough support on some classes. My question relates to racial. Some of the races that have fallen by the wayside. Some of them, we did see a nice update on some of them getting the conversion, but some races did miss that as well.
Yeah, it's tricky with races, because especially something the Feywild is a strong thematic to it. But we're taking a similar approach where we don't want to do new races for the sake of doing new races. So for example, in the Fey book, we did those races because we felt they had a very strong tie to the theme and it would really help the book. But, for example, in the Elemental book, I do not believe there are new races in that book at all. I can't remember off the top of my head, but I don't think we're doing new races there. exactly because of that. Because we don't want to just keep adding stuff at the front, and everything in the back is falling by the wayside. Okay, I'm going to move back over to here, so the ratio of the back.
Just kind of a different spin on the digital distribution question. Have you guys considered or given consideration to opening up the vault and kind of releasing 3.5 editions, second edition books in iBook format, Kindle format, as maybe an alternative revenue stream for you guys, where you're repurposing stuff that you don't have to redesign, you just publish it and send it out the door?
So yeah, so this is I can't give specifics because, like I said, I don't want to say anything until we're ready to go. But I will say, sometimes I think part of the, when people get unhappy with D&D, it's like if you have a band you really like and you really like their first three albums, and when their fourth album comes out, they take their last three albums and destroy them. You can never touch them again. So what we really want to do is, and that's something where, like Rodney was talking about with the Waterdeep board game, we went back to the second edition. We have a giant cabinet. We have a giant entire library in the office with the older edition stuff. Where, why reinvent the wheel when we can just go back to the cabinet and there's the Waterdeep box set and all the books written about it? We don't need to keep just trying to change everything and focus on the new. It kind of goes back to, hey, I get to make a theme. With our races and classes, at some point, you have to go back and look at what you've already done and what got people involved in the first place or what has people excited now, instead of just keep trying to give them the new thing and then nothing's getting support. So.
Yeah, and I mean, the example I use, I hear all these wonderful stories about second edition. I never personally played it, but if I had the opportunity to, you know, go and investigate that, you know,
yeah, exactly.
Easily, you know, I might see what all the hubbub's about.
And Second Edition is a good example because that had the best support for settings we've ever done. I think the best story, and that's something you can use in any edition of D&D.
It's interesting, there's a point at which, you know, I'm a big fan of the kind of wacky classes and races both, but when you reach the point where your party is a wild and seeker and a shard mined scion and there's not a dwarf fighter to be seen, you start thinking, is this still D&D? You know, it doesn't bother me too much if people are choosing dwarf fighters.
So could it reach her in the back?
A couple of related questions, somewhat to what he's talking about, but on the delivery of your products. The first being, it sounds like we're not going to be able to buy Mordenkainen's Emporium online. And secondly, getting back to the PDFs, it's not that I can't afford to pay full price for a PDF, but you have virtually no physical reproduction cost for these things, so charging the same kind of dulls me.
Yeah, so that's part of the riddle of getting the electronic ebooks right for the RPG, is people probably don't want to spend $35 for a player's handbook. Well, how can we? There are a couple things there. So we've got to keep you guys happy. We also have stores and distributors we have to keep happy. We can't go to a store and say, hey guys, give us all this money to stock your shelves with all these awesome D&D books, and then we're giving people the giant reason to go somewhere else and buy them. Because the stores are where you've seen our folks' encounters and their assault. That's where we get new players, and that's where we create a community of players that gets people into D&D and they stay there. So it's a really awkward balance for us that we're trying to figure out how to strike, because we really get one chance at it.
Well,
we mess it up.
Your novels.
Yeah, exactly.
You have these novels that were done 25 years ago and you're charging full price, that makes no sense to me.
Yeah, it's one of those issues where if we bring that novel back in print, it's hard for us to go to make that case to a bookstore to carry it. If we're saying, well, we actually think this book is worth $2, but we want you to sell it for $7 and try to sell that on our fans.
Should we tell R.A. Salvatore that for continuing sales of Homeland, he gets less money because we want to charge less for
the
book?
That's a big issue, too.
Yeah. Zero to republish that book.
That's not true, though.
Well, it's not true. Physically, it doesn't cost anything.
That doesn't mean it doesn't cost anything, though.
Well, it's one of the things where there are costs associated with it. We want to keep authors happy. But we also want to just, you know, with pricing and this stuff, there's a funny thing. I don't want to call it pride, but we don't want to be in a position where we're telling people, hey, our stuff isn't really worth as much as we think it is. So it's a very, it's like the big question. I mean, I can't give you a straight answer because this is like the big question facing media of all types. This is something that's like society-wide, right? I mean, digital is changing everything. And if I could solve this like perfectly and exactly, I probably wouldn't be here. I'd probably be in New York running a big publisher.
Sure.
But it's something which we know because we're customers too, right? Like, I go to RPG Now and buy PDFs and stuff, and if someone has like a $50 PDF, I'm not going to buy it. That just feels crazy to me, right? Just, we have a certain set of assumptions we make when we look at this stuff and say, how much would you pay, right? And if it wildly diverges, then obviously you're not going to buy it. So it's one of the things we're really grappling with and trying to figure out the best way to get this, because we do have, there's a lot of issues on our end that seem invisible, because you're like, hey, I just want to buy a book. Why won't you sell me this book at a reasonable price? But things like author royalties, because that is something we'd have to get a buy-off, especially when it's a percentage, or go back and change contracts. And authors, especially, I don't blame them. They get a little like, well, you know, what's actually going on here? With an author, we can go to an author and say, hey, we want to change, let's make it a flat 50 cents, and then we increase the price, or we go back into print, or there's a limited edition hardcover we're doing. So it gets pretty complicated. As soon as lawyers come into the room, then it gets like, it gets very complicated. So,
what about Morden Canons?
Oh, so that's something too, where we are selling it into hobby stores, but plenty of those stores, they have an online presence. There are stores that'll have a presence in Amazon. So you will, if shop online, still be able to get it. We want to make sure people just can't get the book. But, and Amazon could order it. Like, they will have the ability to order it from us, because we're just purely changing how we're handling the distribution of that book. So, but it's definitely something you could still buy online, I'm sure. And there are plenty of game stores that have online presence that are discounting or free shipping and such. So, but it's really, one of the things that we want to do is really help game stores be a place where people are going to. Because that's how we can ensure the game remains healthy. And the industry as a whole, it's a pretty complex ecosystem. At the end of the day, we can't just walk away from game stores. Without game stores, we probably can't survive. And that's a hard sale to make for the guys who are like, well, I could just take my graph paper, my pencils, my player's handbook, and never need us again. So we definitely are aware of that and trying to balance that. So question right back here, against the wall.
You said that game stores are where new players come. And I guess I'm kind of asking where that information comes from, because in local game stores, I never see a new player. And when someone who hasn't been there before comes in, it's uncomfortable.
So I can give you an exact example. With our games, when we see a store that's selling, that is having more encounters and their numbers go up, we see we're selling more players' handbooks. Like we see more people, and it grows and it grows and it grows. And it's tricky, because there are a lot of game stores out there that aren't really built for that kind of experience. We're really lucky in Seattle. We have some really great game stores. I like this D20 Games of Riverian. It's a really nice store. It's really well laid out. It's comfortable, and it's kind of a cultural change for retailers. So
what
you want to
I'm
keep
asking is, isn't that the exception rather than the rule?
So our Wizards Play Network folks are working really hard with hobby stores that want to participate to help them improve and be a more welcoming place for players to come in for these kinds of events.
But there's also a lot of places where there isn't a store. And maybe they need to find a way to have an option that's outside of the stores to get the players.
Oh, and that's where we have things like with LFR and things like that, where we provide a lot of content for guys play that's free, that you can just, if you want us to host a game day, I mean, we're not, that content's out there to be used. It's just something like when we do with encounters, where we put a lot of support behind it, that needs to go through the store, because we're basically, there has to be a level of trust. I'm talking about the trust between you guys and us. There has to be a level of trust between us and the stores. If we sell the stores a bill of goods on what we're doing, we can't just turn around and break our word to them. I mean, these stores are putting a lot of effort into it. It's not easy for them just to host encounters. I mean, there are stores that might just take Adventure, throw it on a table, and hope someone comes up and plays it. But there are also a lot of stores that put a lot of effort into it. And we can't just turn our backs on that effort and tell those guys, you know, just walk away from them. So a question right here.
At this panel 2 years ago, there was some discussion of products and resources geared toward parents playing with their kids. I guess Redbox was meant for that, and there was one adventure in DDI, but is there any more discussion of a way for my 9-year-old to DM for me?
I actually had breakfast with Susan Morris and other writers. Susan Morris was the original designer of the Heroes of Hesiod, and that is something I'm interested in doing some more support for online. So nothing concrete, something we're just kind of talking about, but that was something that was very popular, and it's something that I think is something we should support. So question right here in the blue.
So earlier we were talking about digital distribution. How about a hybrid approach moving forward where you bundle it with existing hardcover books and do a virtual library the way that you guys used to do with the Magic the Gathering card system and the transactions there, so that if we own the physical book, we can still have the digital coming out and working with us, and then figure out a model moving forward of how to maybe do add-on content through a digital stream as well as a physical book.
Yeah, that's something we have talked about a lot of different ways to do it. Obviously, I can't come out and tell you what the exact plan could be because we're still figuring it out. But we have talked about like the hybrid approach of, like, you know, is there a code in the book? And when 4th edition launched, we talked about you'd buy a D&D product and it has a code in it, and you go to the builder and you type it in and you get that content. Those are all still plans we're looking at. So, but again, we don't have anything exactly figured out yet.
The adventure that had all the tokens and stuff in it, I'm intrigued by that. Can you tell me more about that, including the price point?
Sure. That's Madness at Gardmore Abbey. That's $39.95. It's coming out in September, and I'll let James, you want to talk a little bit more about the story of that?
Trying to remember what I said about it already. So it's set in Gardmore Abbey, which is in the Gardbury Downs in the Nentir Vale, which was built by an order of knights devoted to Bahamut, but it's got some dark secrets in its cellars. And really there's three major patrons who include the Lord Padraig of Winterhaven, a paladin. Wow. You know, this is a box set, and I worked on it a long time ago.
Seeing as for a box set, it has to be, we produce them right now over in China, so that adds like an extra 12 months to like, so James wrote this probably about a year and a half ago.
Yeah.
So, in his defense.
And then there's a Fey Lord, who's the third quest giver, and they all send you on missions according to their own purposes. One of them might not be entirely trustworthy. There's... one of the things that I did with the Deck of Many Things, not only does the deck add random elements to combat encounters where they're present, but there's also some randomization, almost like the original Ravenloft module, where you can determine at random which card the player characters find first. And that actually has story implications. Might determine, for example, which of the three patrons is actually evil and why. So that is worked into the adventure as well.
What levels is that for?
And price point?
It is $39.95.
Okay,
it is for levels 7 to 9 or 6 to 8 or something like that.
You sure you worked on this?
It was a long time ago.
It's that question right up here in front.
Okay, easy one this time, I promise.
Softball.
Right.
Am I wrong? I love themes. When are they going to come together?
I believe, yes. I don't, is, have we announced anything in DDI for that?
We haven't announced it. We were talking with Keith about it at lunch the other week.
Yeah.
I have it on my to-do list. I have a to-do list at work. It's like this digital thing. And I have send Keith Baker an email on that list. So, exactly. Yeah. Just ready?
I've got a question. Are you guys going to produce just some more generic themes? Because I noticed when I was making a couple of characters for the games I went through, a lot of them were very either specific to Dark Sun, so it just didn't fit at all. Or just didn't fit in with what we were trying to do. I mean, just, you know, some, you know, like a questing knight or a lost apprentice. And I know some of those are backgrounds, but, I mean, just some more themes that just for your average players, average group, average game.
Yeah, so we did that when we rolled out the ones a couple months ago, and we had theme month in Dragon. So it's kind of funny, I had the question with Eberron themes and general themes. So what we'll generally do is try to filter through and try to, well, not try. We will make a plan where we can hit on a general themes, general set of themes, and do a couple settings, more specific, then come back. So it's just a matter of rotation. So we did the, I think it was 16 themes total or 12. Kind of feel like, okay, we've done a bunch there. We want to service some of our specific settings, do stuff that's a little more story focused, and then we will come around back to it. So that's one of the things. When we sit down and plan out DDI content, we just take the full 12 months, and then we just kind of go through and say, okay, let's make sure everything is nice and balanced. So everyone's getting a nice, you know, full spread and hitting all the high points with our settings and with different mechanical stuff. So I'm going to come back to Ron. How are we doing on time? Okay,
about 8 minutes. All right.
Question, was the question right over?
Yep. So there's been this phrase floating around that you're trying to find a way to support all editions of D&D. Is that just like in the map kind of products, or is there something beyond that we might be able to look forward to?
So the way I think of it is that if you are a fan of D&D, you should be a fan of us. And if you aren't, we're doing something wrong. And I don't even think in terms of editions. Like I think it goes beyond that. It's just... And realistically, once you get the RPG, it does. But yeah, it's a matter of saying, look, there are people out there who like D&D. Why don't they like Wizards or what we're doing? So in a way, it's just figuring out where are people being driven apart, and there's their ways we can bring them back together. So, the question right up here.
The newer books have a lot more crunch, which... I really like that, but so now it's fluffies before, but now I'm like needing to define some fluff.
And so I have to go into the DDI a lot to read the articles, but there's no way to combine like themes or like, you know, Forgotten Realm articles or you know, is there any idea of like, you know, like doing like instead of breaking them into the Dragon and Dungeon magazines, breaking them out into like other group ideas, like a Forgotten Realms book of the articles, so I can get that as a PDF.
Yeah.
Or so I can actually read that, you know, so you know where, you know, I have all the stuff I need for the fluff stuff.
Exactly.
So, in one spot.
So it's one thing we talk about. Bart is our new, you're the web producer now, right, for D&D?
Yeah.
So one of the things we talked about was right now, for the, anywhere our website falls down on, it's organizing information. Where if it's just like, hey, I'm a Realms fan, show me all the Realms articles, we don't have an easy way for you to do that. And that's one of the priorities we're making. We're looking at the website and seeing just how we can make it much easier to access information and how people want to group that information. So it's definitely something we'll be talking about very soon, probably after the show.
My turn to be difficult. I live 53.7 miles from the nearest encounter store. Have you ever considered something along the lines of a year after the season ends? Next week. Just say a year after the season ends, I could say, go to the Borderlands and find a key.
So if we're going to do anything, in an ideal world, what we would do is create a series in Dungeon, which is supplying that kind of content. So we can tell retailers, look, you're getting your own thing, you're getting the prizes and all this stuff. And then if we wanted to do it, because I think people play D&D, like they play for an hour, they want to play for 4 hours, they want to play weekly. And that's something we want to look at doing more like side tracks and stuff. And this is kind of looking more in 2012. But I kind of talked about this in the Rule of Three articles of saying, look, what kind of players do we have out there, and how can they fit D&D into their lives, and then how can we give them content that matches that? So definitely, I get the question a lot, you know, hey, I want to do like a weekly 1 hour thing that's tied together. So I think that's something we'd want to deliver new content rather than just recycling the old. So that's also something we can make it so if, let's say if it's in DDI, we can tie it to the theme issue that month. If we do an arc of four adventures, we could even do something where we could say, hey, if encounters, you know, you play for the 10 weeks, then you end and start over again. We could create a series of adventures that takes you all the way up to, say, to level 10 in 1 hour chunks and things like that. So it gives us a lot more flexibility because, you know, if you come in month 7 and we're at level 6, you can say, well, I can just go back to the archives and get the level 1 adventure. As opposed to when you go to D&D encounters, like, well, I may end up playing with strangers, but we're all kind of expecting it's week 5 of 10. So we can actually play up to the strengths of the media, the format we're using, to make something that may fit you better. Question right here?
This year with Daggerdale and Neverwinter, there's been a really big push of D&D in video games. Is that something that's going to be continuing over the next year or so?
We have our license with Atari. They have games they're working on. So it's definitely something where we're looking at. I'm going to see where the digital age of getting D&D games out there. So I can't go into details because Atari. I can't, like, they probably wouldn't be happy if I started talking about their plans. But yeah, that is definitely
The Heroes of Neverwinter Facebook game was shown off at San Diego Comic Con.
It's here too.
It's here too.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. So.
I haven't been around.
Yeah, where have you been? You don't seem to know much about it. Yeah. So question right back here.
Yeah, I was just wondering if you could put like a range basic. Uses your highest ability score to
feed
in, so that like the pressure bard is playable.
So write that down. That goes with the same thing. So we have that thread. We have all the lists of like to-do lists. Something small, something's big.
At the end of the dungeon magazine.
Yeah, just throw it in there.
Yeah.
Okay, go on. So next question back here, right there.
So you keep looking at video games, and I get lots of games on my Steam. And Steam really somewhere has their summer sales with like buy all the games by this publisher. It's like $500 for games for $100.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll probably never play all of them, but it's like, oh wow, that's such a deal. And like you go and you get a ton of them. So like if you guys do get around to putting out older content, like your old novels or old, you know, Planescapes and stuff, I think it'd be lovely if from time to time you had a sale and like let us buy the entirety of Spelljammer.
Spelljammer.
We actually
there's another one.
We actually did an experiment this summer. I don't know if you noticed it on our website where we sold subscription access to an Eberron bookshelf. It's kind of a weird thing, but you pay $10, you have 1 year of access to 10 Eberron source books from third edition.
James, I don't know if that's out yet or
we haven't done it yet.
Never mind.
Are you actually James Wyatt? Like, who are you?
Do we need to sign NDAs
before we go?
Yeah, exactly.
It's Bill's Gregland.
Bill's Gregland. New rule. James, you know
Shut
how
up.
I'm talking.
So the takeaway is, we're going to experiment with exactly what you're talking about.
But it was, when we look at really? Digital stuff, and this ties into the entire digital thing of, well, how do we want to do this? And there's a lot of questions, but I will say this, I play games on Steam. I think Steam's really cool.
Yeah.
So it's a pretty cool platform to look at. So.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's see, I'm going to go back here and right there.
Okay. I had a question about the car tour that you guys were playing and supporting in October. Is that going to be like classes or just themes? Is it going to be a one-time splat, or are you guys playing and continuing that? I really love that game.
Cool. No, so yeah, so what we'll do with that, it's a one-time thing. I believe what we're looking at, there's a new build for the Rune Priest. I believe there are themes. We don't have Greg or Chris here who handle DDI stuff. But there's going to be some setting material, an adventure, the honor system article should be an optional thing, so it all kind of ties together. And the great thing with DDI is we can just look at the forums, because if you look at a print book, we might sell however many, 10,000, 100,000, whatever, and then some subset of those guys come on the forums and talk about it. DDI, basically, you're already online. You're probably more likely to be in the forums. So that's a case where we'll look at the forums, look at the number of downloads, how much talk, how many people are excited about it, how many people are using the options in the character builder. It won't be just strictly that. I mean, obviously, a little bit of a different. We won't expect, hey, everyone's using this, so then we'll do it. But it's definitely something where it lets us kind of come in, and then we can do, say, smaller articles to support it, do a little ongoing. But again, I don't want to be in a position a year from now where you guys are saying, hey, we have all these settings, why aren't they getting supported? You did Karateri, you did Al-Kadim, you did all this new stuff. So we just have to manage it. We just do a lot better job going forward managing our yearly cycle of content. So we're making sure we're not going too deep in one direction while letting everything else wither. But then also, on the other hand, we don't want to just do one thing. So it's about striking a balance. But it's definitely something we would look at. So, question right here.
Is there any chance, he had mentioned the Red Box earlier, and you know that was able to be found in Target and Walmart. Is there any chance of any other D&D books or novels being more widespread in different stores like that?
Yes, usually for something like that, like when we go to Target or a Walmart or something like that, we have to essentially design the product for them. They have a lot of strict stuff about how big it can be and stuff. So that's something where you'd hear about it ahead of time, like with the Red Box. We had a lot of, we talk about it a lot. Yeah, but it's something we would specifically design for that market, because obviously there's a difference between the people who shop, say, at Target or Walmart and the people who go to a game store. So that's part of the balancing act. But it's something we're always looking at, and especially with board games and stuff. Like, what can we do to take a branch out into that audience? So, question back here.
So is there a timeline for getting character sheet on the character
builder? I would say that's a different department. I'm just with R&D and digital. I know we've talked about it, but it's just I don't really oversee those things, so I can't really give you an answer.
It's on the list. It's the same kind of thing. It's on the list, but
so we have time. I'm going to do two more questions. I'll do here and here, and then we'll go into our final product announcement. So
the only thing cooler than the original Dragons and the original first edition Two Monster Manuals were the Lords of Hell. We've got Demogorgon, we've got Lolf, we've got Orcus, and we have two Lords of Hell so far. When are you going to support the Devils?
the New Jersey Devils. So we will. That's something we're looking for. That's something we need to see more at DDI. And so we'll keep that in mind when we start planning for next year. And then final question over here.
You mentioned the character builder. Do you monitor the options that are used?
Yeah, so what we do with that is we'll look at not only what characters are getting made, but what characters are getting updated. So someone just makes like a 15th level bard, we can kind of see that. We can also see like, hey, in week one of the encounter seasons, we saw how many thousands and thousands of characters being made. And we can kind of track, oh, okay, these characters are being leveled up. We can kind of see who's playing campaigns, how long they're running. A lot of that stuff, it doesn't necessarily speak directly to content. Like, we will look at classes that aren't getting supported and getting played and figure out what we can do with that. But we don't want to go too far down that rabbit hole, because we don't want to just keep getting into the cycle of, oh, people like fighters. We do more stuff for fighters. Some more people play fighters. And now it's just a few classes getting all the attention. But we definitely pay attention to it. Especially like something like the Vampire is a good example, because we did that in Heroes of Shadow, and we saw a big jump. It like leapt into the top 8, I think, classes. I don't know if you guys remember the numbers. But it jumped way up there and is getting a lot of play. So that's something where we can say, okay, we did kind of experiment and here's a shadow and it seemed to have worked. So could we do a similar class in the future? I think, yeah, we'll be more open to doing something like that. We try to take away more big picture ideas from that than to focus too much on the details. But it does guide us.
But I can throw forth.
Yeah. All right, so we have one more thing to talk about. So we have a miniatures product up here, these dragons. And I want to say about 8 or 9 months ago, we announced we were moving away. Oh, there's nothing actually came up on the screen. Sorry. We don't have sorry. It's just me. I'm just yeah. I shaved, though, this morning, so I want to take pictures. I look at my but the... So miniatures are something which we started in 2003. We went through a lot of sets of them. We had a lot of success with them. But eventually, interest started to fade. So about a year ago, 9 months ago, we sat down and said, what's going on? What's happening? Kind of got back in this mode of, what are people saying about miniatures? And we looked at some of the customer feedback over the years. We looked at some of the sales numbers. And we came to a conclusion that this may surprise some of you, but role-playing gamers, they don't like randomized miniatures. Who knew, right? I just, you know... going through thread after thread and just trying to, like, everyone's like, I love buying booster box. I just take the miniatures and throw them out and keep the booster box. And it's just, you know, it was very like, oh no, but some of you guys don't like that. Yeah, exactly. So we sat down and said, what could we do? Because the traditional thing we said is, hey, when you have all these miniatures, one of the great things about a random model is it makes it cheaper per miniature. So if someone needs spiders and someone else needs goblins and someone else needs kobolds, we can make all those guys happy because we can just do 60 miniatures in a set. We can do some kobolds, some goblins, some spiders. Everyone kind of funds each other, and it all kind of comes out in the wash. Well, I think what happened was early on, people with random miniatures, no one had miniatures yet. So like, oh, great, I need all of those. I need spiders, I need kobolds and goblins. I'll just go buy a bunch of random packs and build up my collection. So buying the random packs didn't sting as much until you had those goblins and spiders, but maybe you didn't have enough kobolds. Like, well, I just want some kobolds. Do I really want to spend $15 or $20 a pack to buy some kobolds? So we think we may have solved this with a product that is going to come out next year. Now, this is something where, when I talk about one of the show things when they're done, this is not quite yet done. But that's something Roddy's going to talk about where you guys can help us. Because what we're going to do is release non-collectible miniatures in themed sets. We're looking right now at sets of 12, and I think including one or two large creatures, built around themes such as drow and goblins. You can buy a box set. We're also adding a skirmish game on top of it, because what we felt was, if we just do a box of goblins, people who need goblins will buy them, but otherwise the retailer may be stuck with, well, there's goblins and drow and orcs. Maybe people don't want orcs that month. So the retailer's stuck with a bunch of orcs. So what we're also doing is creating a new game, a board game that you can play using these war bands of miniatures and fight against your friends. So we felt like that's something that kind of gets nice critical mass. So the role players, if you want whatever you want, you can just buy. And for the board gamers, we're essentially making something like our adventure game system, where you can just, we can just expand it and create new complete sets that you can buy and add to a central core game you're playing. So I want Roddy now to talk about a little bit about this game and what's different about it and what makes us excited about it.
Sure. So some people here have probably played the D&D miniatures games that we produced in the past. And I might as well start off with the big thing. The big difference between this game and that those older games is that it's a diceless game. It is a game that doesn't use the randomization of the D20 to determine success or failure. It's a tactical game where skill is really important. And it's driven by what we're calling right now action cards. And these action cards are basically the commands that you give to your units that drive them around the battlefield. So there's a little bit of a little bit of luck in what cards you draw at the beginning of the round, etc. But then you make all your decisions based on what you've already drawn, and so you can make the more informed decision. It's a little bit more skill-based game than luck-based. And I think what people are going to find is that it takes a lot of the sort of best elements of those miniature skirmish games and really improves on them. So, for example, anybody who used to play the D&D Minis game competitively remembers the tile placement element, where you set down a tile, but it had all these rules. It had to be 2 inches from here, the start area, etc. So what we've done is we've taken that and we've made that a core part of the start of the game. So there'll be these dungeon tiles with the puzzle pieces cut out on them that you slot together to create the battlefield. So every time you play, you can sort of tweak the battlefield a little bit. You're designing the field of play just as much as you're designing, or as you're playing your warband. Additionally, when we look at, you know, we've got all these different sets that we're talking about putting out. Each set comes with the miniatures and the creature cards for that set, but it should also come with different command cards. And eventually what will happen, it won't necessarily be right out of the gate, but eventually what will happen is once you've got a few of these collections, you'll be able to mix and match them and build your own warbands and build your own command decks, etc. So there will be a creative element for the player as well once the once a few releases have come out. So that's just a little bit about the game, and I could stand up here and tell you all day about these theoretical mechanics and everything, but something Mike asked me to talk to you guys about is a different process that we're going to be using going forward with this miniatures game, and that is the fact that we're going to have a public open play test of this game well in advance. In fact, it'll be starting here in the next couple of months where we're going to give you guys the cards online that you can then print out and sleeve, and using your existing collection of miniatures, put together these warbands and playtest it for us. And we'll be letting you guys playtest and then give us your feedback to help us shape the game going forward. Because what I really want to have happen with this game, and I say I, but we as a company and we as a team, really want to have happen with this game is get you guys to use your skill and creativity to help us make it a better game. Because me and Pete and our playtesters and everything could play this all day, but it's going to be you guys that are in the trenches that are going to be playing this game, more often than we will. And so we want to make sure that the game that we produce is something that you guys are all really excited about. And, plus there's going to be things that you'll see that we just wouldn't see, right? So that's pretty much it. But yeah, going forward, open playtests.
So one thing I want to keep in mind, too, is with this open playtest, that's a new thing for us that we're going to emphasize. That if we're going to do something really big and new or a big change to anything, we want to get your feedback on it. We want you guys to come along with us and help us shape it. Because D&D is a community that includes all of you and all of us in one big, hopefully happy family. So that is something which we're really going to kind of use to say, how can we manage this? We have guys on staff now who just manage playtest materials and playtest feedback. And this is kind of a run of that and see how we can manage that and get feedback. So is there a question right over here?
Do you have to be a DDI subscriber to be a playtester?
No.
Excellent.
Well, more specifically, where do we watch for information on the playtest?
Yeah, it'll be on the website, and we're looking at probably mid-September, we're hoping.
That's the goal. Yeah.
So right now, we have sets of the game here at the con. We've been playing with people under NDA right now. We want the really key right now is we just have stuff that's almost hand-drawn right now, or just very crude templates. So we're going to work with our production team to make sure when we're giving you a file, it's something you guys can work with. So that's just going to take a little bit of time. Yeah. And we also have some changes we're making to the rules right now.
And are those puzzle piece board game pieces potentially usable?
They are 100% usable. So they're 8x8 tiles. It's 3 8x8 tiles, is it? Or is it?
So, I don't want to get specifics. Right?
Yeah. But they're 8x8 tiles that you can use. They'll be usable with D&D. And one of the things we did is in the entry areas, right now we have things like doorways and stairs. So you can just put it up and build a little dungeon if you want to use that one.
You mentioned that they're going to be based around things like drow, kobolds, etc. Are they going to be limited edition?
That's something we'll look at. So what we want to do is if we have goblins, we'd want to make sure we have goblins available as often as possible. Now something might go out of print, there's just the production times, but we don't want to be in a position, we don't want to make them like collectible by fiat, but just saying, oh, we've ended up like 5 goblin sets and we're putting them on eBay or something like that. But no, we want to make sure we keep the strongest themes in print and available. So.
Could you maybe include some stat block cards, D&D style, for those types of creatures?
It's a little, so what we want to do ideally with those creatures is create miniatures for stuff you already have. Instead of, it's a little tricky for us because we don't want to drive up the cost too much with stuff that isn't miniatures. That's something we've been looking at and trying to balance. So. We'll take a look at it, but it's not something which we don't want to stray too far away from the core thing of, hey, it's miniatures and a game with it. Question back here.
Are there going to be new spells, and you plan on making packs for like races that are released to you? Wow.
There are some new sculpts in these sets, and we'll just look at it as we go forward of what we want to make new, especially like if we did a refresh, that's when we'd look at that we want to do a lot of new sculpts, so that there's a balancing act there. One of the tricks we have to figure out then is we can do this for things like undead and goblins and orcs. For the more fringe stuff, that was a luxury the collectible format gave us, so it's just a matter of figuring out how can we manage that and how can we deliver in a way that's cost effective and also makes sense for everybody. I think we are just about.
I thought there's going to be more questions, but I think we need to change the room over.
Yeah. So, but we will be putting more news up about this as we go forward. And thanks a lot.